I want to give an introduction to black hole thermodynamics, but I want to build on that discussion we had about the action. And therefore, I wanted to start off by just rewriting down the variation of the Einstein-Hilbert action, which has the piece we want, which is the bulk Einstein tensor. But then also, it has this boundary term, which has derivatives, normal derivatives of the metric. So last time we talked about boundary, or rather submanifolds, and the boundary of a manifold is a submanifold. It has codimension one. And so we can think of adding a term to the action that will somehow neutralize these variations that we, strictly speaking, shouldn't ignore from a Lagrangian approach, being derivatives delta G rather than delta G itself. So I'm going to just give a sort of reasonably brisk sort of indication of how this works. And here we've got this picture that this is our manifold, this is our boundary, and I'm going to fix the boundary and sort of fix the boundary metric or hold the boundary fixed. So that essentially everything that's varying is sort of varying normal to the boundary. So our normal, this is our normal N. Sort of it can rescale, or at least the components can. But I'm going to say that my normal is, I've rescaled it so it has length one. Sorry, my indices right. So I want to get, in order to compare with this term, I'm going to end up needing to have my delta G inverses, so delta G with the indices upstairs, which is minus delta G with the indices downstairs. So this kind of relates, if you like, the delta NZ to delta GZZ. Now, if I want to explore a boundary term, then I have to think of a scalar, something that's a scalar on this surface. Now, I could have the intrinsic Ricci scalar, but then that's also a second derivative of the metric. So it's not obvious that's going to help me. However, we also have another scalar, which is perhaps more appropriate because we want to think of what's happening on this manifold or submanifold, delta M, in terms of it being a boundary to M. So it makes some sense to explore what happens to the trace of the extrinsic curvature because that's telling you about the embedding. So if I look at delta K, so that's like the variation of the divergence of the normal. So I could write it this way.
Sorry. Mm-hmm. Where did the first term come from? delta Na is equal to minus Na and B delta Nb.
So this is really coming, so I said I was giving a somewhat more, perhaps a more algebraically streamlined approach, right? Which is meaning I'm kind of sweeping a little bit of the detail under the carpet, but I think it's necessary for just presenting a sort of, you know, a derivation that where you can sort of see where terms come from. So here I'm holding the boundary fixed. So I'm kind of shunting what's going on into the normal direction. And so I can change the components of my normal vector if my metric changes normal to the boundary. So I'm really taking an approach that's trying to access this rather than thinking about the boundary as a sort of manifold living within the submanifold, living within the manifold, which I might want to do at a different point. Okay, so really this is just saying that what's going on is variation normal to the boundary. So if you can just kind of roll with it for a bit, because if you try and sort of delve in and think about gauge in more detail, it just, it's a lot of extra algebraic complication for no real insight.
Hmm? What is that minus sign?
This one, because if I've assumed N is space-like, because that's what we're going to do when it comes to sort of thinking about boundaries of like the black hole manifold, and also ultimately, if I'm thinking, I'm going to come back to thinking about submanifolds as physical objects, as brains, and they tend to have a time-like intrinsic direction. So yeah, so therefore, when I dot this, when I dot this with N, and N hits that, which gives me minus one. So I get, you know, NA delta NA is the same as NB. Thought it would delta NB, yeah? So if you like, this space-like is coming into there. Yeah, thanks. Oh, dear me. Okay, so now I can replace this delta NA. So here I'm using the fact that the variation, we talked about the variation of the connection when we were deriving the variation of the Einstein-Hilbert action. And so if I trace over these two indices, it's just the trace of G inverse grad delta G. And you can, this is obviously going to turn into minus a half NB GCD grad B delta GCD. So that's going to turn into that, which we can see is this first term here. And then here I have a contraction of delta N with N. So I get minus a half grad A of N NB NC delta G BC. So you can sort of see that the terms are beginning to match up with what we want. Here we can see that I've got something which is going to give me, that's the wrong. Will eventually give me what I want. Wasn't quite as straightforward as that. Okay, so now let me hit this expression with that covariant derivative. So when the covariant derivative hits this N, that gives me minus a half K, and then I've got NB NC delta GBC, I then get two terms which are basically grad n of n. But delta GBC is symmetric. Then I have a term which is minus a half NB and C grad N delta GBC. And then I've got my last term. So a pause with some commentary is in order. That second term, which is completely happening normal to the manifold. If I think about my boundary, I can choose, essentially I can choose a lot of how I define my normal. And in particular, let me put this as an aside. I can choose how to extend the normal off the boundary. That's sort of similar to the fact that, you know, we can choose if we're in a higher codimension submanifold, we can make our normals twist as much as we want while we move around. I can't choose to set things about how the parallel part extends off the boundary. That's much more determined by the geometry, but I can choose how to extend the normal off the boundary. So I can set that to zero. It's not anything physically relevant. So picking up the line of reasoning, I've still got my first term. Now, if I look at, let me see, this term here, okay, so what I've done here with this term, I've got two normals, NC, NA, grad A. And so I've said that I've used the fact that my first fundamental form is equal to the metric plus NN. So therefore, two normals together is equal to the first fundamental form minus the metric.
You said that's the first fundamental form, and then it would be like H minus the metric, and why the metric is delta?
So, because one index is up and one down.
Oh,
yeah. So down, you know, remember H downstairs was equal to GAB plus NANB. So I raise one index and I get HAB is delta AB plus NANB. Yep. Yeah, it's all just about sort of, you know, cycling things around till you kind of get to where you want to be. So this bit here was where I was aiming at, right, in terms of finding that boundary term there. And so now all I'm left with is kind of the top term, but actually here I can rewrite this. So if I put this squared piece, so this is, if you like, my boundary term, or half of it. I mean, in some sense, I don't actually need to go much further because from a Lagrangian perspective, I'm home and dry at this point because this term here is a total derivative of something lying completely within the boundary. So normally, if you have a total derivative, it integrates to a boundary term. But here, delta M is already a boundary, and the boundary of a boundary is zero. So the total derivative term just doesn't contribute. And what I'm left with is my boundary term plus something which is proportional to delta G. So I'm kind of done my job, so to speak. So therefore, if I had delta of the integral of k root g, that's going to be equal to half times the boundary term that I wanted. And then I have this term here. I've got plus a half KAB delta GAB. And then I have minus a half KNBNC. So as I said, I've finished my job from the perspective of the Lagrangian, because if I'm doing a Lagrangian problem, this piece just vanishes. It's now proportional to delta G. So this second term, this is what Gibbons and Hawking did. As they were trying to develop some sort of partition function approach for gravity, they realized that if they thought about the boundary as a submanifold, took a sort of sensible scalar, then they could make the Lagrangian approach to gravity work as they got rid of these normal derivatives. And not only that, but as we're about to see, that boundary term now allows us to discriminate between different vacuum solutions for gravity. Because even if R is zero, that boundary term will end up giving us a contribution.
Do you mind repeating why that step where we set this to zero in the Lagrangian?
So if we think about this as being our gravitational action, the Lagrangian approach is I vary my action with respect to my observable field, which in this case is kind of to do with distance. So I vary it with respect to G. We saw when we were doing the action, if I do delta SEH with respect to G, I get the bulk term, which is what I want, the Einstein tensor. I get a boundary term, which is full of normal derivatives of G rather than G. So whereas I set, you know, the usual rules of the game are you set your variation to zero on the boundary. So what I've then done is taken that extrinsic curvature, which we know is sort of related to normal derivatives of the intrinsic or first fundamental form. And so we've kind of varied that, and we see that we get exactly that boundary term plus some pieces that look like delta G. So we've traded, if you like. We started off with a four-dimensional action, which was where our Ricci is not, you know, normally you have grad phi squared. Your normal Lagrangian is first order derivatives in your field. The problem with geometry is the Ricci scalar second order derivatives. So we end up with the boundary term being a first order derivatives. We add a piece to that, which we know talks about normal derivatives to the boundary. And we see that the variation of that piece cancels off these normal terms and leaves us with now no things that are not a derivative, but we set those to zero by the rules of Lagrange variation. Sort of. It's just saying, you know, I mean, actually, these have an interpretation of themselves if you're not fixing the boundary, but I didn't want to go to completely general gauge because it just gets a mess. Mm-hmm.
Well, then they are varying the k square root of g integral in the middle. Are we already working on the boundary?
I mean, I've sort of taken a few liberties with this, but it's because whenever I try and make it absolutely watertight, the algebra sort of just gets a little bit more explosive. So I tried to just get the essence here.
So the integral is already on the boundary.
The integral's on the boundary of that Gibbons-Hawking term, yeah. So it's really just taking the integral of the extrinsic curvature on the boundary. I'm not worrying too much about whether it's delta G or delta H because, you know, in essence, I'm going to set it all to zero anyway by the Lagrange rules. So,
excuse me.
So if you're, yep.
So when you're varying reading, and then you said that everything that is proportional to delta G will set it equal to zero because of, you know, variation rules. And I was wondering, because, you know, this is actually how we can find the Einstein's field equation, right? GAB is equal to kappa T mu nu by, like, setting that equal to zero. So here we also would have, like, another formula. It would be, like, KAB would be equal to K times HABC. So we will have this.
Actually, you would then relate this to a sort of energy momentum source on the boundary. If you were thinking of the boundary not as a sort of fixed construct of, you know, like a sort of boundary of a space-time, but if you were imagining it was some submanifold, then if it was a codimension one submanifold, you might be thinking of making that boundary move or at least vary. But then you have to be a bit more careful about what gauge you've chosen. But this then gives you something called the Israel equations, which tell you how our geometry changes as you go through a sort of shell of matter. So I just want to recall what we did with Schwarzschild. So I think it was at the end of the last lecture I wrote this down and then showed you that if I wanted to make R equals 2gm not singular, then I had to take tau periodic with a periodicity 8 pi gm, and then argued that was sort of equivalent to a thermal field theory, if you put field theory on that background. Now, if I want to draw my geometry, if tau is periodic out near infinity, my space-time looks like a cylinder with a sort of two-sphere over it of radius r. So this is the r coordinate. So that's what my space-time looks like at large r, but at small, or as r tends to 2gm, it's just the origin of polar coordinates. So what this really means is that my geometry curves around so that locally at 2gm, it's just like flat, it's an origin. So this is the, sometimes called the black hole cigar.
What's going on in the 2GM again?
So that we did this at the end of last lecture. A 2GM, in order to make it non-singular, we change coordinates to make it look like the origin of polars, and therefore we deduce that tau is a periodic coordinate, and it has periodicity 8 pi GM.
Yeah, and it's like periodic at the end of the cigar, right? But at the like the other end, it looks like, you know, it's a point. Like, you know, it just gets like narrower and it's like closed at the end, right? But like at the other end, it's like periodic.
At the other end, it's a cylinder and it's still periodic, just like the angle is periodic near the origin.
But the other end is like the cone, end of the cone. Like,
it's not a cone, that's meant to be smooth. This is meant to be smooth. It's just like the origin of polars. Yeah, phi, r, just like that. It's just locally flat. The tau r is just local, it closes off. So that is what the geometry of a black hole looks like. But over every single point there, you've got a two-sphere of radius r. So the topology is r squared cross s squared. That's the topology of a black hole. Whereas hot flat space as topology r cubed cross s1. So the Euclidean action I have to analytically continue, and then I have to actually do a flip of signs. So is just the Gibbons-Hawking term.
Sorry, Ruth, why are we saying, so the R3 cross S1 hot flat space, what's that generally like supposed to be the?
So if you're doing field theory at finite temperature, but you're just ignoring gravity, then what you do is you kind of analytically continue to Euclidean time, but your Euclidean time is periodic with periodicity 1 on t. So you're doing field theory on this space.
Wait, sorry, what? The other one, is this if we're kind of relating the black hole picture to this picture? How come that we find this one's periodic in Euclidean?
I'm saying if you do field theory at finite temperature, this is how people calculate field theory at finite temperature. It is in Euclidean space, you have a periodic time. So I was contrasting the topology of a black hole with a topology of just flat space, but at finite temperature.
Is that one supposed to be with Euclidean time as well?
This one has, yeah, this is Euclidean time. Yes, I've analytically continued to Euclidean time. So I gave this whole story, I think, I can't remember whether it was last time or the time before, saying that when, you know, with Gibbons and Hawking were trying to take a Euclidean approach to quantum gravity in the 70s, and therefore they were looking at a partition function approach. And so the idea is, just like with a path integral, you have some boundary, right? And then you say that you're going to fill that in with some manifold, yeah? And then you take the action of that manifold, and you're weighting your probability, your paths, by this sort of integral of the action of that manifold and over all manifolds with that same boundary. So that was what they were trying to do. There were various sort of obstacles in the way. The fact that the action has sort of some serious negative modes. But the two main the main obstacle was that if you just had the Einstein-Hilbert action, then anything that was a Ricci flat solution with the same boundary would have zero action. So it didn't discriminate between different solutions. And so that's how they got the Gibbons-Hawking boundary term. But the reason they just didn't give up was the fact that Euclideanizing the black hole gave you the same temperature that had been calculated using a Lorentzian field theory approach in the background of a collapsing star. So it was this that was the clue that there was something going on here. Okay, so if this whole approach is going to make any sense, so you know, if you're going to sort of integrate over metrics or whatever, this some sort of Euclidean action, then you have to be able to discriminate between different solutions. So here, what we want to do is we want to look at the Schwarzschild solution, and I'm going to put a boundary at large R, and I'm going to calculate that boundary term and see what I get. So my boundary just has an intrinsic metric, which is just the two-sphere times that circle. My normal my normal is just proportional to d by dr, and I've made it negative because I want the normal to be pointing into my manifold. So my extrinsic curvature, which is just divergence of the normal, so all I have to do is find now the way in which that sort of surface curves in its into the interior. So it's just the 1 over r squared dr r squared times root 1 minus 2 gm and r. So that's minus 2 over r root 1 minus 2 gm on r. And then it's minus gm over r squared, and then it's divided by root 1 minus 2gm over r. So that's my extrinsic curvature. And so I can see that it's equal to minus 1 over r squared root 1 minus 2gm on r, and then I have 2 into 1 minus 2gm on r from the first term, and gm, sorry, 2r minus gm. So evaluating k on my surface at large r, I get 1 over r squared root 1 minus 2gm on r, and then I've got 2r minus 3gm. So that's my k. Then my sort of root, my intrinsic volume form is equal to r squared sine theta root 1 minus 2gm on r d tau d theta d phi. So that's my volume element on the boundary. So you can see we've got a problem here, because this r squared is going to cancel that one. That square root is going to cancel that square root, and what I'm left with diverges with r. So that's a problem.
Why do we add this, the Gibbons Hawking action to Emma? I forgot. Big picture.
Big picture. The big picture's hiding over there. The big picture is that we want to have an action for gravity that is completely consistent with a Lagrangian approach. The problem with the original pure Einstein-Hilbert action is that it isn't. because it leaves us with a boundary integral that involves normal derivatives of the metric, which we cannot consistently set to zero. Okay? So therefore, we add a boundary term to neutralize those normal derivatives and leave us with just delta GAB, which we are allowed to set to zero by our Lagrangian rules of the game. So that's why we put it in. Another way of seeing it, though, might be if you just didn't think about boundaries at all, but you imagined that you had sort of shells of matter, and then you looked at what happened to gravity as you go through the shell, you would end up with this sort of approach anyway. So it's all kind of nice and consistent.
So what was the physical meaning of this new term?
The physical meaning is that it gives you an action that is a genuine action, and it allows you to do Lagrange variations. You have to add it in order to be able to say that the Einstein equations really are the equations of motion of gravity, and you're not getting some extra terms that are pinning you to some boundary. You know, you really want these Einstein equations to be the free equations of motion in your bulk. And in order to do that consistently, you add this boundary term so that when you make your Lagrange variation of the full action, what you find is you get your bulk Einstein terms and something which is proportional to a variation of the metric on the boundary.
But why would we want to add this term to cancel that thing? Is this just a guess? We guess something like...
Well, no, I gave you Gibbons and Hawking's motivation. They were looking at doing a Euclidean approach to quantum gravity, and they, you know, they were saying, well, if I take the path integral approach and I translate it to geometries, I'm going to say I have a boundary and I'm going to integrate over all manifolds that have that same boundary and weight that with the action. That's what we do with the path integral, yeah?
Yeah.
So they hit a couple of problems, one of which has never really gone away because, you know, Euclidean quantum gravity isn't really quantum gravity. But apart from that, the other bit that they had was the fact that the Einstein-Hilbert action doesn't discriminate between vacuum solutions of general relativity. So that was one issue. There was the boundary terms in terms of thinking about it from a Lagrangian perspective. Both of those are solved by adding the Gibbons-Hawking boundary term. And so now, when you ask, what are the manifolds that have this same boundary, yep, what are the action of those manifolds, you find that, as we're about to find, although we've hit a slight there's a little speed bump along the way, you find that now different geometries have different actions. So here, my speed bump is that this is divergent. So that's a bit of a, oh dear. Yes, question.
I have a question about, like, in Gibbons-Hawking term, we converted the metric determinant using a G.
So why did I change it to H? Yeah, in this case, it's because of the way I've set up the boundary and the fact that N has length 1. So actually, root G is the same as root H in the way I set up there. So it's really root H because that is the local measure, but in the way I've set this up, I know it doesn't look obvious. I just explained at the start, I didn't want to do it in a general gauge because otherwise this would have all been formulae and it doesn't really give you any additional insight. So root G is the same as root H when I fix my gauge in this sort of normal, you know, that definition of the normal. I'm kind of setting coordinates, if you like, so that my normal is sort of got length 1.
So is it the same value, like the H and G? The
in that gauge, yes. In that gauge. But it's just where I played by that rules of the game. In general, if I'm integrating on the boundary, I have to integrate with respect to the local measure. So here, for example, R is not, doesn't tell me the proper distance as I move away from my boundary. R is, it's proportional to it, but it's not the proper distance. So it's not the same as that gauge there. But yeah.
So here we add like a beta here. I know that, you know, we wanted to play somehow go to thermodynamic and stuff, but isn't it just one here beta? Like, isn't it just like integration of like sine theta, d theta, d phi?
So the d theta, d phi is 4 pi, and beta is the periodicity of tau. Okay? So that's why this came here. But now I want to just compare my integral of the boundary in Schwarzschild with the integral of a boundary of flat space at finite r. And this is my boundary of flat space at finite r. And I can kind of read off what k is because there's no root 1 minus 2 gm on r. So my k0 is minus 2 on r. Therefore, if I go through this whole sort of similar calculation, my integral of k0 sort of d3x is equal to 4 pi beta 0 times 2r. So flat space also has a divergent in boundary integral. And so this is not really, shouldn't phase us too much to get an infinity. If we have an infinity in vacuum as well, it just means that we have to do a background subtraction. Now, you'll notice I've been very careful there to write beta 0 and not beta, okay? So our background subtraction is and you'll see I've put that in capitals because the key phrase there is with the same delta m. And you'll notice if you compare the delta m of Schwarzschild with the delta m of flat space, you see that tau zero is the square root of 1 minus 2 gm on r tau. So I have to sort of rescale, if you like, my flat space time to fit with the Schwarzschild time. So that tells me beta zero is 1 minus 2 gm on r times beta. So therefore, if I look at my background action, which was 4 pi beta 0 times 2r, this is therefore 4 pi beta root 1 minus 2 gm on r times 2r. which is roughly 4 pi beta into 1 minus g m on r times 2r. Sorry, I keep forgetting my action. It's this over 8 pi g. Because the action is 1 over 8 pi g times that integral. So therefore, my actual subtraction, my normal renormalized action of Schwarzschild missed a minus sign somewhere. Yeah, here, so sorry. K is minus that. Ah, that's minus there, so that's minus that. Oh, something wasn't adding up. So with some work, what we've shown is that we can define a sensible Euclidean action for Schwarzschild that is finite, and also, at least within the class of these solutions, is unique. So our action depends on M. So I could also write this as 4 pi g m squared, or so let's see, beta squared over 16 pi g. So I can write it sort of either way. Wondering what I can fit in to discuss. So this then feeds in to our partition function, which is a sort of trace over e to the minus, I guess, beta h, but it turns out to be e to the minus Euclidean action. And our entropy s is beta squared d by d beta of minus beta inverse log of z . So if I play around with this, I get . So here I'm really just using quoting a definition at you for how you find the entropy if you have the partition function. But if you use this value, you see that the entropy is the area over 4G. Now, if I just think of what happens to Schwarzschild, my area is, if I just do it in shorthand, it's 4 pi r plus squared. So delta of area is equal to 8 pi r plus delta r plus. But r plus is 2gm, so that's 8 pi times 2gm times 2g delta m. And I can rearrange that as delta m is delta a over 4g times 1 over 8 pi gm. And so that is t, and that is delta s. So we see that from a, I mean, I don't expect you to find this convincing whatsoever, because there's only one thing being varied here. But this was really how, right, you know, before the notion of a thermal background coming from the black hole had been proven, this was kind of how people intuited a first law for black holes, because, you know, I've simplified it down here to Schwarzschild, but if you look at the Kerr metric and you imagine throwing a particle into Kerr, so you allow the angular momentum to vary, you allow the mass to vary, you end up, or indeed Riesen and Nordström as well, you end up with something that is, some function times sort of delta A over 4G. Then you have some other function related to angular momentum times delta J. And then you have some other function which is related to an electrostatic potential between the horizon and infinity related to delta Q. And so whereas these things could be specified at the time with, you know, so this was kind of Bekenstein who conjectured that you had some constant of proportionality over M times, again, some other number, delta A. So that's how they intuited in the early 70s that the area was related to entropy, because if you didn't assign an entropy to a black hole, then you could reduce the entropy in the universe by just chucking stuff into a black hole. So, get Doctor Who episode with that, right? So, but here, so when they look just within the family of solutions of Kerr-Newman, you got these relations coming up. And so there was this strong feeling that area has something to do with entropy. And then, you know, because there was a classical theorem that area of the horizon always increased, that was like the second law of thermodynamics. And then it was really just the constant. And so it was that constant that was obtained by looking at what happened to a vacuum to the quantum vacuum as you came in. If you had a collapsing star, what happened to the in vacuum and how was it related to the out vacuum? And so that's how that constant of proportionality was derived. So it's weird because the notion of black holes actually radiating is very much buried deep in quantum field theory, and yet all of this really is just a big classical discussion. And this first law of thermodynamics, which you can generalize to cosmological constant, even acceleration, is all looking at classical families of solutions and varying the parameters. So it's this really bizarre mix of the classical and the quantum, but it works, what can I say? So anyway, I'll stop there.